From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. In less than 3 weeks, Dr. Joshua Sharfstein leaves government for a job at Johns Hopkins. In his nearly 4 years as Maryland's health secretary, he's helped lead the rollout of Maryland's health insurance exchange, reshape the state's unique power to set hospital rates, and tried to combat a surging heroin epidemic. We ask him about the challenges left for his successor. Then, why are baseball salaries climbing through the roof? And how has the NFL weathered this season's litany of scandals? Tom Hall asks our sports guru, Mark Hyman. Plus, Rabbi Zvi Dov Slanger founded a high school and rabbinical college here in Baltimore in the late 90s. But more than 50 years before that, he escaped death in a Nazi concentration camp thanks to a train. He tells us about it. First news.
I'm Nathan Sterner, and if you were listening to Maryland Morning Live, I'd be bringing you the latest Maryland news right about now. You can catch the live show Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 FM in Ocean City, and online at WYPR.org. For now, you're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Let's get the show underway.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks to everyone who contributed to WYPR during our year-end fund drive. You really came through for us, and we promised to make the best use of your pledges. Your support makes our work possible. Thank you. At the end of this month, Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, Maryland's health secretary, will leave his post to become associate dean at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. As he departs, we wanted to know what has been accomplished during his tenure, what public health challenges will be left for his successor to tackle. And Dr. Sharfstein joins me in the studio to talk about it. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
The Health Exchange website has run much more smoothly this year, but as of last week, about 25% of Marylanders who had signed up for private insurance before have renewed. The deadline to renew and keep the subsidy without interruption is next Thursday, December 18th. Why do you think so few people have renewed so far?
Actually, I think we're on track. We announced yesterday we've had about 77,000 people come back through the new website, including 44,000 people on private health plans, which is just tremendous numbers. We're so far ahead of last year, you can't even, you know, we stop counting after a few days. We do want people, particularly people who got financial assistance in 2014, to come back through. Others can renew and stay in their plans. So it's I think we probably are about halfway through the highest target group, and I think that's probably consistent with where most people are in terms of their decisions about buying insurance. You know, people generally wait till closer to the end. So I think we're in for a pretty busy week next week.
It's just a much shorter sign-up period than last year. People don't have nearly as much time.
True, but just to give you a sense, the first 3 months last year, we signed up 19,000 people in private plans. The first 3 weeks this year, it's 44,000. So we're just so far ahead of where we were last year, and the site is just working so well. I was over at the IT headquarters yesterday, and you can see at every moment how many people are in the application. We had 853 people signing up for health insurance at that exact moment. Just so much more than we had last year. And people can get on and off within 20 minutes. We had one of the insurance brokers wrote us an email saying that this year it's crazy easy for her to get people insurance.
Crazy easy?
Yes. And so I said, well, you know, we've gone from crazy to crazy easy, which is a good transition.
Governor-elect Larry Hogan has promised to declare a state of emergency to fight the rise of heroin overdoses in Maryland. Naloxone, the prescription drug that can save someone from an overdose, will now be available in pharmacies across the state. What else needs to be done?
Well, we've been very focused on overdose this year. Governor O'Malley issued an executive order back in June, and that has led to a tremendous amount of work between the different agencies, including with respect to the reversal drug, Narcan. We've trained more than 4,000 people around the state to use it.
Is that the same as naloxone?
Yes, sorry, it is the same as naloxone.
Okay.
The state police use it. Increasingly, the local police departments are carrying it. Every basic life support ambulance now has it. And we changed all the Medicaid rules to make it very, very easy for people to get it without any kind of hassle at the pharmacy. So that's one major part of the approach. We have been doing a lot with respect to doctors, because doctors both need to recognize when people need drug treatment, but also need to be careful about how they're prescribing pain medicines, because that starts to get people into trouble with medicines if they can't do that. And for the first time ever, the Board of Medicine has adopted a education requirement that every doctor licensed in the state of Maryland has to take a course on how to appropriately prescribe opiate medicines. In addition to that, we're seeing a significant increased use of the prescription drug monitoring program in the state. We have been working very closely with the police and with criminal justice and the corrections to get information about overdose to people as they're leaving detention, to have police officers be able to refer people to drug treatment on the street. We have done some very interesting data analyses that show that the risk of an overdose is 8 times higher in the first week after leaving detention than afterwards, probably because people go back to using the same amount of drugs that they were using before, but their bodies have adjusted so that they're very high risk to overdose. So I would say that those are some of the major things we're doing. I think that in all of these areas, there's more to be done. With respect to Narcan, it's great that we've trained 4,000 people where we didn't have anyone before, but we can train more and the word can get out and more doctors can prescribe. We've written every doctor in the state telling them which patients should be getting a Narcan, a naloxone prescription. But following through on that's really important. With respect to drug treatment and recovery funding, where Governor O'Malley has invested a tremendous amount of money and resources, and we have one of the best drug treatment systems, I think that there's more room to go, and we certainly wouldn't want to take any steps back.
As I mentioned, Governor-elect Hogan talks about declaring a state of emergency. What would that change in the picture, in your view?
Well, I think that's more of a question for him. I think when we looked at the kinds of things that we felt were necessary, we were able to do them with the governor's executive order without a formal declaration of emergency. Typically, when people declare emergencies, they're doing it because they want to waive state law for something. So, like, for example, in an infectious disease outbreak, we could declare an emergency, and as the health secretary, I could force hospitals or doctors to do certain things. I mean, it's a pretty serious authority that rests with the state in those circumstances. But I'm not aware. We certainly didn't consider things that would require waiving state law, but I think you'd have to ask the new administration what they plan to do.
And, of course, we will. That's Maryland Health Secretary Dr. Joshua Sharfstein here on 88.1 Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about health in Maryland. The United Health Foundation's annual rankings found that Maryland has made the biggest improvement in health since last year of any state, and the biggest improvement over the last 25 years. But they also found high violent crime rate, lots of air pollution, prevalence of babies born at low birth weights. Overall, Maryland ranks 16th among states now, even though it is a wealthy state. What do you think will be your successor's most pressing challenges?
Well, I do think that the story of health over the last, say, 4 to 8 years is that there have been huge improvements in Maryland, and there's still a lot of room to go. We have not, taken all the work off the table, but at the same time, you can see that today. I think we're going to do a press release saying that since 2007, we've seen a total of 600 fewer unexpected child deaths in the state of Maryland compared to what we had in 2007. Significant declines in children dying. I mean, we would like to see, of course, all those numbers lower. But if you look at lower infant mortality rate, the improvements in teen pregnancy, the improvements in child death unexpected, it's really been an incredible story, and I think we really do appreciate that we were the most improved state on this most recent rankings. I think that there certainly the fact that the entire East Coast is now awash in heroin, and we're seeing this significant new overdose issue over the last couple of years is going to have to be a major issue. And I do appreciate that the new administration is focusing on that. And in addition to that, I think that the larger work that we've done in Maryland, which really makes a huge difference, is aligning the healthcare system for health. Typically, or, you know, really for many years, you know, the people get sick, they go to the healthcare system, and then health is just something that happens on the side, or maybe there's a vaccines and a little bit of prevention here and there. But those two things have really come together. Right now, particularly with the way that we're paying hospitals in Maryland, the success of the medical system depends on keeping people healthy and really
their financial success
and their, you know, whether or not they view themselves as a success, I think, it depends on keeping people healthy. So there's now this incredible momentum in the state for people to get together and dream up ways to keep communities healthy, for communities to dream up ways to keep themselves healthy. And I think that maintaining that momentum and really extending it is just an incredible opportunity for the next administration.
What was the hardest part of the job?
The hardest part of the job is the fact that it's a very big enterprise, and there are always immediate challenges that have to be dealt with. So you have to be able to try to focus on the longer term strategic vision at the same time you're fixing the problems that are coming up. You know, you may recall early on we dealt with a series of murders that happened at the Perkins Hospital. So we had, mm-hmm. you know, that hospital now got the highest accreditation, but it was a lot of work to get that back in place. We've been working with longstanding challenges at the Developmental Disabilities Administration. And, you know, we recently saw that we've shrunk the number of audit findings down from 13 to just a couple. But a huge amount of work to get there. And the challenge is that you can sit in this job and just deal with the things that pop up every day and never get to a strategic vision, never really move the needle on health because you're just trying to deal with the things that pop up. So that balance between making sure you're taking care of problems that are there as well as thinking and working on the longer term things that are going to pay off is very hard to strike.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, Maryland's health secretary. He will leave that job at the end of this month to become associate dean at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning. Mark Hyman's here to talk sports with Tom. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
Morning, everybody. Thanks, Nathan. And thanks to everybody who pledged in our year-end membership campaign. I really appreciate it. We all do here at Maryland Morning for the support and the interest that you have in our work. And we just are so grateful to everybody who made a pledge. And if you haven't gotten around to it and you still feel like doing it, you can go online to wypr.org and make a pledge. But we are certainly very grateful to everybody who helped us out. I'm Tom Hall. We are going to talk some sports this morning. There's lots going on in the world of sports these days. And to give us his take on the O's and the Ravens and other timely topics, we welcome once again Maryland Morning's sports guru, Mark Hyman. He's a journalist and author who is currently on the faculty of George Washington University. His latest book is called Concussions and Our Kids. Morning, Mark. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, Tom.
So let's talk about the Orioles. The winter meetings of Major League Baseball just concluded yesterday. Lots of teams making lots of deals, and there are lots of folks who think that the Orioles were kind of eerily quiet. We've lost three pretty good players here, some fan favorites indeed. Nick Markakis is going to Atlanta, Nelson Cruz is going to Seattle, and Andrew Miller is going to the Yankees. And I think there are some folks that thought, well, okay, now that we're at the winter meetings, we got to make a big deal. Didn't happen. Where do you think we are? Is it time to press the panic button on the Baltimore Orioles?
Well, so far the offseason has been notable for the subtractions and not the additions, which is, I think some fans are nervous about that. But I think it really is too early. Remember that last year the Orioles made the most important moves of the offseason almost during spring training. I think, you know, several weeks before spring training, they signed Nelson Cruz and Ubaldo Jimenez. So I think it's much too early to draw any conclusions about you know, what the Orioles roster will look like on opening day.
Nick Markakis took out a 2-page ad in the Baltimore Sun telling everybody that his family is going to stay here. They're going to continue to live in Baltimore County, even though he's going to be playing for the Atlanta Braves. He was certainly a fan favorite. Nelson Cruz led the major leagues in home runs last year. We lost them both. How come those deals fell apart?
I think one of the issues is the length of the contracts that the players wanted. You know, of course, players want the longest contracts they can get for the security and the money that that provides. And in the case of Cruz and Markakis, they were both looking for 4-year deals. And the Orioles have been very reluctant to go to 4 years with players. They have done it. Adam Jones signed a 6-year deal a couple of years ago, but at the time he was 26. Nick Markakis is 31, and I think Nelson Cruz is 34. And it's a calculation. I mean, how productive are those players going to be in the third and fourth years of big contracts? I think that's what the Orioles were looking at.
And in Major League Baseball, unlike other professional sports leagues, a guaranteed contract really means a guaranteed contract. It's different, like, for example, between Major League Baseball and the NFL. How does it differ?
Yeah, and I don't think this is well understood by some fans. Major League Baseball, which has a very strong players union, the contracts are guaranteed. So Alex Rodriguez, for instance, we hear a lot about his contract, which was 10 or 12 or maybe 20 years. I can't remember, but a very long contract. And the teams are on the hook for all of that money, every dollar, as opposed to the NFL, where typically players sign for large signing bonuses, and they are guaranteed the first year of their contract. But beyond that, it really is at the club option. So that's a significant difference, and teams in Major League Baseball are at much higher risk in terms of long-term contracts.
So Nelson Cruz signed with Seattle for a 4-year contract, a $58 million deal. The average of what he'll make each season is actually a little less than the Orioles offered him, but the Orioles only offered him 1 year, and that was really the deal breaker for
him. Remember that last year the Orioles got Nelson Cruz at a discount rate, a 1-year deal at $8 million. That was far below his market value, and it was because of his past. He had had some issues with PEDs and the suspension, and there were great concerns about what his productivity would look like. Now, he turned out to have an awesome year, led the American League in home runs with 40. But, you know, now that he's established himself again, the market for Nelson Cruz was much different than it was a year ago.
The contracts, the numbers just get more astonishing and sort of unbelievable every year. I mean, there's this fellow who just signed with the Marlins in Florida. I never pronounce his name right. Giancarlo Stanton or something like that. A 13-year deal, $325 million. I guess it's at this point the largest contract in all of pro sports, just not just baseball, but any other professional league as well. It just seems like an enormous amount of money, and you know, can the Orioles compete in that kind of environment?
Well, to put this into perspective, remember that when Peter Angelos bought the Orioles in 1993, he paid $173 million for the franchise.
Yeah, for the whole team.
For the entire team. And that, at the time, was the highest price ever paid for a professional sports franchise. And that's not that long ago.
Yeah, and here's this one player making twice that himself.
Yeah. And I think what needs, we don't talk about enough, is the extent to which revenues in professional sports have grown. In 1995, revenues for the entire baseball industry were $1.7 billion. This year, they're going to be $9 billion. Mm. So not only are the players making a lot more money, but so is ownership. So, you know, we hear a lot about what players are making, not so much about what's happening on the ownership side. They're making a lot of money, too.
Mark Hyman is our guest this morning. He's talking about sports here on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. You know, and the revenue increases in Major League Baseball, I mean, over 20 years, you know, $7, $8 billion. But even just in the last 2 years, revenues have gone from $7 to $9 billion in Major League Baseball. Where is this money coming from? I mean, they've got new revenue streams that Peter Angelos and other owners in the 1990s probably couldn't even imagine, right?
Yeah, I mean, think back to 1993 and what existed in terms of access to and media around baseball. There was no, you know, the internet as we think about it now really didn't exist in 1993. Now there is a dedicated MLB.com website against which Major League Baseball sells advertising and generates a lot of revenue. There's an app called On Deck, which I have downloaded, and I know many other fans have. You can listen to the radio broadcast of any major league game, both sides. So if the Orioles are playing the Indians, you can listen to the Orioles broadcast, to the Indians broadcast. That's a revenue stream that didn't exist in 1993. And there's a network, the MLB network, which I've been watching 10 hours a day during the winter meetings. That didn't exist. So another revenue stream that, you know, Major League Baseball has been very shrewd in exploiting the digital side of its business.
Yeah, and I suppose if the money doesn't go to the players, where is it going to go, right?
Exactly. It's not going to charity.
They're certainly not like reducing the ticket prices or anything for people. It's still a very expensive affair to take your family to a baseball game.
That's right. I mean, the price of tickets, of course, is increasing. You know, the cost of going to a game is not going down, but there are many, many more opportunities for ownership to generate revenue than there were 20 or 25 years ago.
So let's talk about the Ravens. They have been generating a fair number of points. Their offense is actually, although there have been some quarters where you think, oh my gosh, this offense can't do anything right. But the offense is overall a better operation than it was before. But they are in a very difficult division. They are 8-5 with the Steelers. The Browns are 7-6. The Bengals are 8-4 because they had a tie. But basically, everybody in that division is in contention for the playoffs. How do you think this is going to? And lucky for us, we're facing an opponent on Sunday that is 2-11. So
yeah, we've got a
pretty good chance.
Yeah,
for Sunday.
It's the only division in football in which every team is above 500. So, I think the Ravens are still in the wild card hunt, but they're looking to win the division. I mean, that's a guaranteed ticket to the playoffs. And having not made the playoffs last year, I mean, that's definitely the goal for this team.
Of course, they've had a lot of stuff on their minds other than football this year. The Ray Rice scandal continues to unfold, and Haloti Ngata suspended for drug use, missing the rest of the regular season. If we do make the playoffs, he'll be back for that. People talked about, you know, the deleterious impact that this is going to have on the NFL. Are there any signs that either the Ravens franchise itself or the NFL as a league are suffering because of these scandals, Adrian Peterson, et cetera?
I think this is a really interesting part of the story. The NFL and the Ravens have been in crisis management mode for months now, going back to the initial incident between Ray Rice and Janae last February. But from a purely a business perspective, look at the NFL, and I think you're hard-pressed to see that there have been any negative consequences. Television ratings are still high. There have been very few sponsors that have dropped out. Some have made noises about being unhappy about the NFL and its image, but sponsors have stayed with the NFL. So I think the impact from a business perspective has been really amazingly minimal.
This week they announced a new conduct policy, player conduct policy. How does it differ from the last policy, and what's the consensus about whether or not this is really going to help matters?
Well, the NFL has been under fire for a disciplinary policy that I think has been perceived as lenient and arbitrary. And Roger Goodell, the commissioner, has taken some steps that I think will address that, or at least some of the criticism in that direction. So it's a new personal conduct policy established by the league that was announced this week. And for the first time, Roger Goodell is not going to be kind of the judge and jury, at least not at the earliest stage. The league is going to be appointing a special counsel who will be responsible for evaluating the circumstances of the player and determining what the policy or the penalty should be. And then if there's an appeal of that penalty, then Roger Goodell will get involved. So, I think Roger Goodell is probably relieved to have this new structure in place, because he's not every issue is going to be coming directly to him.
So, for example, had this policy been in place at the beginning of the Ray Rice situation, perhaps it would have unfolded in a very different way.
Well, Roger Goodell would not have been the first NFL official to have been in the position to, you know, pass judgment on what would happen to Ray Rice. The other interesting thing about the policy is it applies to anyone who works at the NFL, so not just players, mm-hmm. but front office officials, executives in New York, and, you know, at least in theory, to ownership.
Well, domestic violence is a real issue. It's a serious matter. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, whether or not the NFL can actually make a dent in stopping it. Let's move to college sports. A local team here tonight plays in the semifinals of the NCAA Soccer Championship. And you may not guess that that local team is none other than UMBC. So the chess players are putting on the soccer cleats and going out, and they're playing the likes of Virginia in the Division I NCAA Soccer semifinals.
That's just an amazing story to me. The four teams left standing in the NCAA Soccer Championship are UMBC, the University of Virginia, Providence College, and UCLA. Now, that's a pretty amazing statement about the soccer program at UMBC.
I want to put some kudos out to Brad Craddock. He is the place kicker for the Maryland football team, and he is the top kicker in college football. He was given the Lou Groza Award. He came from Australia 3 years ago, having never competed in football before. This is really quite a remarkable thing.
Yeah, great story, and he's just amazing. He's got great distance and very accurate kicker, so... agreed. Kudos to him.
Good for him. It puts Maryland on the map in the national spotlight. Speaking of college football, the College Football Championship Series has been settled. They've got a new system this year where the two teams will play in two bowls, the Rose Bowl and the Sugar Bowl, and the winner of those two bowl games will play in a championship game. Refresh our memory about why this was supposed to, you know, why they're doing this in our 30 seconds remaining here.
Yeah, well, you know, up until this year, there's been an unofficial champion, and there's never been a game to determine the champion of college football.
Because it was done by polls.
It was done by polls. There were two polls, and they're kind of dueling polls, and sometimes the polls didn't agree. So this year, we have a system that identifies four teams that play for the official championship of college football.
And those four teams are Alabama. They'll play Ohio State in the Sugar Bowl. And then Florida State will play the Oregon Ducks in the Rose Bowl. And then a week or so after that, on a Monday night, they'll play the championship. But there are some teams that still do have a legitimate claim to having been they could have been chosen in that group before. I know I have a brother who works for Texas Christian University, and he's saying, we was robbed.
Well, right. I mean, you can't take controversy and, you know, opinion making out of something like the college football championship process. So there's still going to be people who feel like, you know, they should have been in.
So real quick, the other big sporting event this weekend, the Army-Navy game, the 115th playing of the Army-Navy game, happens at M&T Bank Stadium just the day before the Ravens game on Sunday. What a great tradition that game is.
Yeah, and we're so lucky to have it in Baltimore. The game rotates between or among Philadelphia and the Meadowlands and Baltimore. This is our year. And Under Armour's outfitting Navy this year, that's going to be an interesting part of the game.
That's too. Right. So these were uniforms commissioned for the game, right?
Yeah, and they're extremely patriotic.
That's fantastic. All right, well, Mark Hyman, always great to see you. Thank you so much, and we will see you next time.
Thank you, Tom.
Mark Hyman is on the faculty of George Washington University. His latest book is called Concussions and Our Kids.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. This month marks the 70th anniversary of the arrival of the Kastner train in Switzerland. During the Holocaust, Rudolf Kastner, a Jewish-Hungarian journalist, negotiated a deal with Nazi SS Colonel Adolf Eichmann. Kastner arranged for a train to rescue nearly 1,700 Jews from Nazi persecution. In exchange, Eichmann demanded about $1,000 per passenger. There'll be a celebration in Baltimore on Sunday of that train touching freedom. The founder and dean of the Orthodox High School Beis HaMidrash and Mesifta of Baltimore, Rabbi Zvi Dov Slanger, was a passenger on that train. He was just 10 years old. When we went to his school late yesterday, Rabbi Slanger told us about the terrible conditions when the train left Budapest, Hungary in June 1944. No seats, no real toilets. He told about the fear that the train would be sent to the Auschwitz death camp and the terrifying hours when they thought a shower would turn out to be a gas chamber. You can hear those memories on our website. Then I asked Rabbi Slanger about arriving at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in Germany 3 weeks after they left Hungary.
They brought us to a place, home houses with rooms, long houses, and they put us in about 100 people in a room, three tiers of beds, three, 12 people in one, and then the next one, and the next one. And was no, as I remember, was no mattresses, only straw was on the bed. And then we started our days in Bergen-Belsen. In the beginning, we had food, because it took us with us food. We are not hungry, but after a week or two, started the hunger, and the hunger was terrible.
And that lasted for months?
For months. It was terrible. I can tell that what I remember as children, we were afraid to go to sleep, because we knew that we were going to be dreaming, that you have some food to put in your mouth, and you wake up the moment when we...
Wake up expecting food, and there's nothing.
Nothing. The hunger was terrible. It's the whole day you think about food. And the other thing that was terrible was the Appell. Appell is a German word for counting the people. When they had to count the people, you have to get out to line up 5, 5, and 5, and 5, and stay like that when the German come, and they never had the correct number. And if you have to stay there for hours, if we, in the summer and hours in the winter, and people were very weak, it was a terrible episode every day.
On WYPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Kass, speaking with Rabbi Zvi Dov Slanger, who's celebrating 70 years since escaping Nazi-controlled Hungary. He is dean of the Orthodox school Beis HaMidrash and Mesifta of Baltimore. So the train arrived in Switzerland 70 years ago this month. You were 10 years old. Do you remember how you felt when you got to freedom?
We had to wait hours on the platform, an open platform. There was negotiation with the Jewish Rescue Committee. They had to work out with the SS officers. We waited hours, and we did not know if we were going back to Auschwitz or we are going to Switzerland. And after a few hours, the deal was done, and we entered the Swiss train. That was the first time that we felt the air is warmed. It was for us like to be in paradise. We did not know what does it mean to be a heated place. And we were settling down, was normal chairs, normal seats. And the conductor came in. And the moment that he came in, everyone jumped up straight. If not, the Nazi can beat you up. So he was taken back. What happened here? Everyone is jumping. Someone explained to him. But it happened many times on the trip. It was not a long trip to St. Gallen, not a long trip. And a few times he came in, but the second time was not afraid anymore. But we also, after that we left, we was laughing that we were doing it, but it was mechanical. And then we came to place where soldiers used to live, and a few days there, and they were careful how to feed us, not to feed us too heavily, small, get used to the food, because thousands of people died because they ate normal food.
Your family moved to Palestine the following year, in 1945, 3 years before the State of Israel was created. You came to the United States almost 50 years ago in 1965, and it was very important to you to establish a school. Why was that such a clear goal?
It was not, that time it was not my so clear by me. They want to establish a school. First they had to learn the language. I did not know English at all. I was in different places, and the last 26 years before I established, I was in Baltimore, in near Israel Rabbinical College. I was teaching there. And then I felt that I want to have the education similar, very similar to what I got in Israel. And I felt that it's more close to what I saw in Israel than what was in Europe. In Israel was exactly like in Europe.
Did you feel there was some special obligation that you had as someone who had come so close to being stopped by the Nazis?
I think so.
Why?
Listen, if God saved you, you had to do something for that. And I felt that was he wanted for me.
So tell us about the school. How is it doing?
School is growing. Now we have 135 students, hundreds in high school, 35 in the college level. And it's growing very fast. Now it's growing very fast.
What will be the message of the gala celebration on Sunday?
To recognize that the Creator saved us and we are obligated to follow what He wants from us.
I really am grateful to you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Rabbi Slanger is founder of the Beis HaMadrash and Mezifta of Baltimore on Old Pimlico Road in Baltimore. His high school and rabbinical college is holding a gala of gratitude Sunday evening to mark the 70th anniversary of Rabbi Slanger's arrival in Switzerland. At our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, we have links to more information and how you can register if you'd like to attend Sunday celebration. Or you can call 410-486-0006. 410-486-0006. Our thanks to Payam Aga Gassam, who produced this segment. I'm Sheila Kast. Glad you're with us today on 88.1. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
We have production help from
Connor Graham,
Payam Agagasam,
and Elizabeth Sherwood.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
Sunday is December 14th. On that date in 1799, our first president, George Washington, died. I'm Sheila Kast. We're back Monday and hope you'll be with us.